Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee in the studios of WMOT-FM. Dr. Doug Heffington teaches a class called Rural Settlement. It's good for History 4471 and Geography 4470/5470, which is University Talk 4. You can take it as an undergraduate. You can take it as a graduate. And it gives people a chance to get out of the classroom and go into the rural areas of Middle Tennessee and find out what's still there, what's missing, and come to an appreciation of it and document it, because it turns out that a great deal of what once was about bucolic areas is no more. Some of it is still there, but in a slightly dilapidated form. And Doug has taken me on a nice little drive through the countryside to show me some of the areas just around Rutherford County where old country stores have been located in the past. And thanks for doing that, Doug. I really enjoyed
it. It was
that.
A pleasure. It's good to get off campus and do stuff, so it worked well, I think.
Yeah. This is not the first time you've taught this class, is it?
No, it's not. I was previously in the Department of Geosciences and have recently moved to the Department of History and was able to take some classes with me to CrossList. And this is one I had taught previously in Geography and Geosciences, and now teaching in History, and it's always had a field component to it, as all my classes, whether it's cultural geography or historical geography. I think the thing that makes rural settlement work so well here on campus is that our campus is really not MTSU. It becomes Rutherford County or Bedford County or East Tennessee, or however you want to phrase it, we really do operate within in some ways, a living laboratory of the past, whether it's the cultural landscapes of the past, the historical geography of the past, the rural settlement of the past, is that we have it here. And so part of the goal of the class that we have is to try to capture some of that. But I think, Jennifer, probably as much as anything, is that I want the students to understand is that this is not my past necessarily. It's not my assignment. This is their past. It's their assignment to make of it what they will. And I think a lot of the students are realizing that they really do, especially the ones that are from the area. It's like you see the same places every day, and all of a sudden over the years the luster kind of goes away. And then with assignments like this, there seems to be that art of discovery, that newness, that all of a sudden it's like it is cool to look at these old country stores, or to look at rock fences or silos or things that are what we refer to in geography as relic features, relic geography. Because they say something. They say something about us. They say something about our past cultural landscape, but they also say something about the cultural landscape we live in today, which is consistently over the last few years been one of the fastest growing counties in the United States. Is that with that comes urban sprawl, and with sprawl in some ways equates to demise of the rural landscape, the country landscape.
Where did the majority of your students come from? Do they come from the rural areas, small towns, urban areas? What's their interest in this?
In this class specifically, you always ask the classes, but I know in rural settlement this semester is that I was surprised that most of them are from rural areas. Many of them from rural areas in Rutherford County, but they are from areas out there. Even some of the I guess you'd call them small new bedroom communities of Murfreesboro, like the Christianas. But we've got kids that are that were literally raised on farms and understand what a rural landscape is, because that is part of their fibers, part of their genetic makeup. But we also have kids from the rural areas of West Tennessee. And so we don't have many outside of here. Most of them are from the Nashville Basin, but the ones that are in the class do seem to be drawn from those rural areas, because again, I think it's part of them.
So this does not fit the stereotype of you can't get the kid to unplug the iPod long enough to appreciate where they came from or where their ancestors came from.
I think with the generation now is that there's certainly some removal. But we've talked in class, and I can't tell you how many times this semester, not out of my mouth, but out of the students' mouth, is that they start talking about grandparents and occasionally the great-grandparents. And so they seem to be kind of going back in time and said, oh, yeah, I remember that, you know, or I remember my grandmother saying that. And I try to tell them stories about, I try to put me in there also, because I mean, I'm a few generations removed from these kids. And so it's funny how when you put yourself back like that, there's still some type of common thread, because the country stores, for example, I went to as a child aren't much different than what these kids went to as small children. So they understand there are things that are going away because they remember. Mm-hmm. They're mining the landscape of memory, which is a cool thing.
What do the kids have to do syllabus-wise to prove to you, Professor Heffington, that they have gotten out there into the rural area and they have done their research?
Well, the last thing that we just completed, and they turned in their assignment last week, was that, you know, you try to kind of jazz it up and to make it where it doesn't seem so hard, is that we called it a rural landscape scavenger hunt. And there were things on the landscape that they had to document, and not just go out and take a photograph, but if they could find information, whether it be primary or secondary sources, stories from parents or grandparents. But they also had to map it. So, you know, in their lap or in the seat next to them, they had a Tennessee Gazetteer where they could actually tell me this is exactly where this rock wall is, or this this silo, or this rural cemetery, or country store. They had to look for eye-style houses. I mean, things that denote to us Middle Tennessee, that make us a part of us. And so they seemed to enjoy it. I was surprised last week in class. I wanted to discuss it some, but I didn't. This is a 3-hour block. I was surprised that they took up most of the class, because everyone wanted to make sure that everyone heard what they had done, their trials and tribulations, the adventures of the journey, but also where their things were found, where their items were found. So we were throwing stuff on the screen. We were, you know, using thumb drives to load things up. People had discs with photos on it. It was really kind of a neat class, because everyone wanted to be heard.
Clearly there is academic value to what's being learned here, but sometimes the key to getting people to learn is to de-emphasize the academic jargon and make it seem like it's not an academic exercise at all. And the more fun you can make learning, and the more hands-on you can make learning, and perhaps the less classroom-bound learning is, sometimes it takes hold more strongly and for a longer period of time, don't you think?
I think so for a lot of students. Now, you know, and there's always students that prefer the more traditional class, so I try to mix it up. I do lecture. We talk about the morphology of a cultural landscape, the morphology of a rural landscape. You know, how do you define a village? How do you define a hamlet? How we compare to the British system? Why we have a township range? Why we evolve from meets and bounds? So there's technical stuff in there. There's technical items. I mean, there's geography. There's history. But the bottom line is that that's me talking to them. That's me showing a film or showing photographs. But until they see it, until they do it, it doesn't seem to quite, as you said, it doesn't seem to lodge in there for any degree of permanency. So I do try to mix it up. We talk for a while. We do stuff in class. And then we go outside the class. We get in the field. We come back. We retool. We share. We plot and plan. And then we start up again. So I think that's one of the reasons the class, and again, some of the other classes like cultural and historical geography have done, I think, frankly, they've done pretty well, because I think the students see this as kind of a non-traditional classroom, which I also find odd because, again, being older than they are, this is how I was taught. But somehow in that time frame, the classrooms become a lecture, and it can be more.
So what is happening to rural Tennessee? What is happening to the rural landscape?
Well, all you have to do is take a short drive, and you can tell it's being gobbled up, nibbled away at on a regular basis. It appears at times almost in a 24-hour a day. There's just things that simply go away. But if you look at us here in Tennessee as a whole, is that, you know, we're still, we have firm roots in the past, and that past is rural, it's country. There's still a tremendous number of acreage of rural landscapes. It's just simply changed. The traditional farm that many of us think of has gone by the wayside, to, you know, people moving out of the city to as we were driving today, to raise burros or to raise exotic animals or to put some type of small business, or the horse industry, for example. So it's rural still, but it's a different kind. And Tennessee's not alone. I mean, this is what's happening to the country as a whole, is that, you know, farms, the traditional family farm is certainly, I won't say go by the wayside, but it certainly has diminished. But and I know I'm starting to rattle too much, but it's like, you know, just recently a couple of young farmers here in Rutherford County were looked at as the Farmers of the Year for the state of Tennessee. And I remember one name, but I do not remember the other, so I won't use them, but out on Halls Hill Pike. And so there is still a generation of folks that this is genetic. This is in their heritage. And it was kind of cool to see these guys being interviewed on TV. It's like you could tell, you know, they were kids, you know, 20s, early 30s, but I am a farmer, and my living, my livelihood for me and my family is off this land. And that is becoming rare. And if we can capture glimpses of it, these kids, if the students can recognize that there's still at least these relic features, then we've won something.
So there are people who have farming in their blood and are lifelong farmers. There are people who dabble in farming but really just live out in the country because that's what they want to do. Then again, living out in the country can mean building yourself a McMansion, mm-hmm, and living behind a wrought iron fence. Or living out in the country can mean living in this little bitty house that's been there for a long, long time, but it has nothing whatsoever to do with farming. Is there a sense of community anymore, or is it just individuals who happen to live in the country?
You know, I have no firm documentation, just other than my gut feeling is that the sense of community is, if it's there, it's not as strong as we were driving through Rockville and we were talking, is that people in Rockville still kind of, they cling to the fact that they live in Rockville, but I think you see that diminish in other communities, is that I simply live on my land. And as you and I were talking, is that, you know, we come from families that did Sunday drives, and we went into the rural landscape, the country, and drove around with families usually on Sundays. But it was different then, is that we drove in country that people were farming. There were no emus, there were no exotic animals, there was no nothing odd. It was farm after farm after farm.
And gas was cheap enough to allow you to drive.
It was. And then you bumped into a country store, you got something, you got a snack, you got something to eat, whatever, and you kept on your journey. And so there wasn't a lot of break in that. It wasn't a monotonous landscape. It was just a consistent landscape. And what we see today, in my opinion, is that the rural landscape is there. It's just become a mosaic of different usages. Is that it might be the guy doing the exotic livestock. It might be next to, as you said, the McMansion. It might be next to the guy who just, I don't want anything to do other than I just don't want to be in the city, and I'm willing to drive into Nashville to work. And that's okay, because in some ways it does lock up that land from development in many cases. But those people are being pushed further and further out to those fringes, because if you look at a Murfreesboro, is that I came here in 92, and which I know might seem like a long time to some people, but it really isn't a blink of an eye in how much of this town has gobbled up, eaten up the rural landscape. It's rather staggering, just casual drives. It's just amazing what was there yesterday is no longer there.
We talked while we were on the road about the country store being the hub of the rural community, and the disappearance of those and the few that are still left. Some of them are not exactly the country store looking in the traditional sense. You know, some of them are cinder block, mm-hmm, or whatever, but that most of them seem to be on corner lots, and a lot of them are just, you know, they're boarded up. They're still there. They haven't been refurbished or remodeled. But on the other hand, there are no people inside actively participating in commerce either. So they're fun to look at, but it's kind of strange for them to be there. It's kind of like they're zombie stores.
I mean, they're kind of like shadow features. I mean, they say something about us then, but I'm not sure what the statement is today. I mean, it's hard to get a handle on. Are they valued? Is the property valued? I'm like you. I'm often amazed is that why just sitting there? I mean, you do see some revitalization. We saw one today out toward Rockville that had been turned into a cabinet shop. You go to Miller's Grocery in Christiana, and it's become a very successful restaurant. So you see some retooling, but those are the exceptions, not the rule. How we got into this is that we all drive by and look at them, but people don't really, I hate to say jaded, but it just becomes a part of the landscape. But I was at a conference back in the spring of last year, and a professor of geography over at University of Tennessee was the keynote speaker, and his name is John Rader, and he's written, his latest book was on Appalachian folkways. And I was asking John about the book. I said, I was becoming interested in country stores. I said, John, you've got a page out of this fairly large volume on country stores. And I said, why wouldn't there be more? He said, because no one's done anything with it. And that was kind of the trigger. It's like, you know, could we use students to do something with country stores? And starting to drive around and look at the landscape more closely, it's like Rutherford County is, with all this urbanization, is dotted with these things. I mean, it's covered up in country stores, and we're heavily populated. So what we're doing in this class is that is what geographers do. They start out with, in some ways, the most simple, is that we're simply trying to map them. We want to know where they are now, the state of their condition. And then from there, try to piece together settlement patterns, infrastructures, transportation systems. But it's, I think that when I mentioned that art of discovery, that light bulb coming on with the students, that I've driven past that store every day going to Middle for the last 4 years, and I knew it was there, but I never knew it was there. That's what we're trying to reverse, is that take that second, take that breath, and look at that piece of the past, because they are going away.
So what you're really doing is exploring a niche that has gone largely unexplored and undocumented as a whole, and yet it, at the same time, the real gift, if you will, is the light bulb that you're turning on inside of the students themselves. You know, the thrill of discovering something new that was right under your nose and you didn't really appreciate it before. That's, you know, whether you're doing it in history or geography or political science or biology or whatever, that's always exciting. That's, if you can be turned on by learning something new, anything, then maybe that's a turn on that'll stay with them for the rest of their lives.
I hope so. Sometimes the best gift that you can get is the gift you already have. It's a part of you. It's a part of our culture. It's a part of our landscape. And to have that new recognition, all of a sudden, it does seem to mean more. So we're trying to get that into the student's head, is that, you know, cherish and value the landscape now, but also the landscape of the past, and try to put it in a proper perspective.
Now, they're not so modernized, are they, that any of them fail to realize it? Look, if it's cutesy country quaint and there are about 50 of them, that doesn't count, okay? We're talking about, we're getting you to search for the genuine article here, not something that somebody has franchised out.
And we talked about that. It's like, guys, this is not Cracker Barrel and this is not Love's Country Store. I mean, this is the real deal. And I think one of the hardest questions to answer, and we talked about this today driving, is that, well, Doug, how do I know it's a country store? And it's so hard to define because, as you said, almost none are in business. But you know it's not a house. And that's what I told him. I said, you just simply have to get out in the field. You have to take those drives. You have to take those walks. I said, you'll start to get a feel. It's like, that's not a house, even though it might be boarded up, or people might even be living in it, or it might be readapted to something else. Is that you can simply tell that there's something different about that structure. As you mentioned earlier, I think geographic location is one of the first things to look at, is invariably in a T or in a crossroads. Not always, but often. And those are kind of clues. Those are indicators to the past. And so you learn to read that landscape.
Does the stereotype of sitting around the old pot-bellied stove and eating crackers in days of yore still apply? Is that a true image?
It certainly was, and I think there's still vestiges of it. You go to the Forbes store up in Palmetto, you see some of that today. But in our county, not much. You get glimpses of it at Miller's Grocery. But for the most part, they're simply just abandoned. And when you talk to the students about how that old building at one time, even though it looks old and dilapidated now, that really was for that community. That stretch of farmers, that was their window to the world. That's where they got news. It might have been their post office, where they got the latest items. They exchanged stories. They exchanged gossip. They met with friends. It was a window, and it might not look like it now, but at one time it was vital to a community. It was vital to those people that made their living from the land.
And it wasn't just food and feed. It was sort of a mini department store. They'd get cloth in there for women to make clothes with, to make dresses with. Were there ever, back in the day, eateries mixed in with the country store, or was it a situation where if you wanted to buy some food and eat it there while you were jawing with somebody, you could? If you wanted to buy it and take it and go, you could. It's not as though they had a little mini diner inside the grocery store.
That's a good question. And, you know, and honestly, I'm not sure. Is that, I know today is that you see a lot that have kind of done a combo job. It's out of business now, but there's a Crockett store that I've worked with in Rosebud, Arkansas, of all places. And kind of just fell into it on a drive while visiting family, is that I was struck by the fact that it was truly a general store that was owned by brothers that bought it a little over 50 years ago, and they were going out of business because the family didn't want to carry it over. But they would sell food, and so you know, you go in, it's like, you know, and it, the variety was small. It was like, you know, we've got bologna, we've got hooked cheese, and we have white bread. And do you want mayonnaise or mustard?
It's not like you get scrambled eggs and bacon.
You couldn't get that, but it's like you can eat it here, or you can take it with you. But, you know, I was curious as they were fixing the sandwiches, you know, this is the new coming out, and you're looking on the wall to see if there's any type of, you know, is this approved by the county, by the state? There's nothing. I mean, they're just making sandwiches. And I think there's still those out there, but it is becoming harder and harder to find them. But then, in turn, I think some of the country stores are still in existence. They're having to diversify. They're having to do something different. I'll use Forbes again. Is that, you know, they make their own fudge. I mean, in some ways they've mimicked parts of Gatlinburg just to try to get people to stop for just a second, come in to see what they have to offer.
Something unique. Something is not. You're buying it in a store, but it's not store-bought.
Exactly.
By definition.
Exactly.
We were talking also about whatever happened to those places that used to sell fish bait, crickets and minnows and worms. Even growing up, I can remember the stores that sold those things.
I am not from here, but have been here for a while. The last one I know was at the Crossroads at Walter Hill, and it's now out of business. And I'm sure there's others out there that I'm just simply missing. But we were talking about it when we were growing up, is that oftentimes in the country store, you know, separate from the food and from the merchandise that you might originally come in for, is that there was the cricket box and you could buy the little containers of worms, and you had the minnow tank, and you could, whatever you needed to go fishing, you had it right there. So it was, in some ways, they were pre-Walmart, and I honestly do mean that. I mean, they carried as much variety as maybe a large department store. It's just not as much. And what they didn't have on the shelf is that they could get it for you. Mm-hmm. So that could be everything from a bag of minnows to, like you said, to fabric, to chicken feed, to a bologna sandwich.
It harkens back to a day, doesn't it, when, prior to intense government regulation, which I am not putting down as a bad thing, but it was more a sense of, in that rural community, you knew that old Robert behind the counter wouldn't steer you wrong. You knew he wouldn't overcharge you. You knew he wouldn't poison you with bad, dated food because he was your neighbor and he lived right there in the community, just like you.
I mean, that store was your store, and you're right, it was built into the community, and the community was built into the store. And so it was always a safe bet. I was reading Rader's book again a couple of weeks ago, some of the passages, and one of the things, and it does ring true. He talked about, in that page, when he was doing surveys, his original purpose was to survey log structures in East Tennessee, but he told his students, the first place you need to go to is not the community post office, not to a mayor, not to the police station. You need to go to the country store and tell them what you're doing. Because if you do that, everyone's going to know what you're doing. And John was right on that, is that it's the safe place. It's the place where for information shared. And so even today, if you can find them, and the students, and I know my students that are doing work mapping these stores, is that if it's open, they go in. And for the most part, people will talk and talk and talk.
Isn't it interesting that all the places he told you not to go were governmental entities? They're telling you to stay away from institutions. I mean, we as people create institutions, like they are man-made constructs that we use to try to govern ourselves and try to create some sense of order in a society. But it's the human unincorporated, if you will, one man or one family store that becomes the hub of social activity, not all of these formalized agencies or the offshoots of institutions that we go to when we seek the heart and soul mm-hmm. of the area in which we live.
I agree. And I think, I think historically is that you had these farmers living on their farm, whether they're raising cows or raising corn, whatever. But the magnet that pulls them into that nucleated settlement is or was the country store. And that's why I think Dr. Rader had his students like, you have to go there, because if you want to get it to the source right off the bat, and then from the source get it out there when you show up on someone's property asking them to photograph a double pin log cabin, is that they're going to know beforehand that you're coming, that somehow by the grapevine, is that it's happening, that you're there. And I don't think we have many things left in our culture that can truly do that, even in this mass communication age. The tried and true tradition of word of mouth is different now. I don't know if we have that cultural clearinghouse that country stores were.
When the students go out into the country and they talk to people, are they well received after they explain to them what they want to do and the purpose of their being out in the country? I mean, they can go to the Historical Society and the library and the Gore Center all day long, but when they actually go out into the area, do the folks in the community receive them well?
All I know is what they've told me, and so far, we've not had any bad experiences. Is that is in some ways just the opposite. Is that for many of the country stores that are still operating, is that during the day, oftentimes business is rather slow. It's that pre-work crowd, that post-work crowd. And so they have found at times it's difficult to get away from the store. People want to talk. I have had a couple of students that would say is that no one was unfriendly, but some were not as friendly as others, but everyone talked to us.
How do they still survive economically in areas that have been, you know, bypassed by the interstate? They're off the beaten path by definition.
Well, they've had to find some type of niche. You go out to the Crescent store, for example. I mean, you know, they now sell Witt's Barbecue. It closes early, but I mean, that pre-work crowd is pretty busy there. That post-work crowd, people coming home, is pretty busy. So they fill that very narrow, that sliver of the economy. And I think in some ways it's that economy of ease. It's like, you know, I know I could stop at Kroger's, but wouldn't it just be easier just to pick up the loaf of bread, even if I have to pay 30 cents more, to be in and out and home? And I think that's what they bank on. And I think for some of them, they bank on it successfully. They do well with it.
Well, for those of you who would rather take the scenic route and enjoy all that has to offer, including green trees and flowers and relatively fresh air. After all, we are talking about areas into which people drive cars. Doug Heffington teaches rural settlement. It's a class here at MTSU. Can be used for credit for both history and geography for both undergraduates and graduate students. And you will not be bored, and you will not feel as though you were stuffed into the pages of an overly priced textbook and left there to die. Right?
That's my opinion, yes. I will agree wholeheartedly.
Dr. Doug Heffington, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome, and thank you very much.
This is MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, at MTSUnews.com, you can check out the podcast at your leisure, as well as archived podcasts of previous shows, and We're downloadable at iTunes, too.